I was catching up on my blog reading and I saw a link filter post about Zach's blog.
This is a 16-year-old kid who's beholden to his family who's put him there.
The word was spreading from one blog to another.
At the nexus of the sexual revolution, gay liberation, and feminism, he became a legend.
Jackie was more of a performance artist than a drag queen.
Welcome to the 900th edition of This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer couples make progress in Europe and North America. Blog-born protests aim to rescue a gay Tennessee teen from conversion. And a Warhol superstar moves from house dress to history. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 25, 2005. Slovenia's parliament this week gave its final approval to a bill creating registered partnerships for same-gender couples that carry some of the benefits of marriage. The vote was 47-3, but that's misleading. There are actually 90 deputies in the chamber, but most of the opposition parties stormed out after an angry debate. And it's not just conservatives who are displeased by the new law. Three civil rights groups plan to challenge it in constitutional court because its benefits are so limited. One of them, the National Society for the Integration of Homosexuals, is calling on lesbi-gays to protest by not registering their partnerships. They say the conservative government's bill introduces sexual apartheid instead of equal rights and protections. What those partnerships will offer when the law becomes effective a year from now is legal recognition in areas including property, housing, and responsibility for mutual support. Partnerships also carry some rights to inheritance and standing in medical situations that is less than next of kin. But they do not include such social security rights as health insurance or pensions, and the government rejected activist demands for parental rights, including adoption and artificial insemination. Despite its limited nature, the new law is still a remarkable achievement for an Eastern European nation that's predominantly Roman Catholic.
Also in Eastern Europe this week, the Czech Parliament gave a 90% favorable vote on first reading of a registered partnerships bill, including rights to inheritance, medical information, and mutual support, but excluding adoption. Previous partnership bills have failed in the Czech Parliament. Despite disagreement within the coalition government, Social Democratic Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has been personally lobbying for the bill at the behest of lesbian-gay groups, who believe it may have a better chance of passage before 2006 elections.
Germany's registered partnerships have been strengthened by a court ruling this week. The Berlin Administrative Court ruled that references to a spouse in pension benefit plans should be understood to include registered partners. That means the Berlin Medical Association will have to pay death benefits to the male partner a deceased male physician had named as his spouse, despite the pension fund's claim that only a marital partner could receive them.
In predominantly Roman Catholic Spain, religious opposition defeated the socialist government's bill for marriage equality in the Senate. That doesn't kill the bill, which is still expected to be enacted by the parliament in the coming week. But the Senate defeat was unexpected, and it came when Catalan Christian Democrats joined the conservative Partido Popular in opposing the bill to give the nays a 5% edge. However, the Partido Popular, which blocked many moves to recognize same-gender couples during its long rule, did apologize for the offensiveness of a guest speaker it had brought into the Senate, a psychiatrist from a Catholic university who described homosexuality as a pathology resulting from a violent, hostile, distant, or alcoholic father, or a cold, overprotective mother, and as often associated with depression and drug addiction. The socialists called that speech grotesque and Paleolithic.
Spanish politicians couldn't help but notice more than 200,000 people, perhaps as many as 500,000, who marched through Madrid this week to protest marriage equality. That march was led by the nation's top Catholic clergy in what's believed to be their first participation in a demonstration opposing a government initiative since Spain became a democracy. The organizers of the march, the lay Catholic group Forum for the Family, have promised more such demonstrations if gay-supportive Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero doesn't meet with them. Group travel was arranged for participants from even the outer reaches of Spain, and some 60 other nations were also represented. The Federation of Lesbians, Gays, and Transsexuals had not officially planned to stage a counter-demonstration, citing respect for their opponents' right to demonstrate, although several hundred supporters of marriage equality did gather near the march route. But many more took the opportunity of a huge concert nearby to express their support.
Also marching against equal treatment of lesbian gays this week were about 800 members and allies of Poland's far-right groups in what was billed as the normal parade through Warsaw. That was intended to contrast with last week's equality parade that saw some 2,500 lesbian gays and allies march, despite the objections of Warsaw's Mayor Lech Kaczynski. The mayor had complained about police protecting the lesbian gays from skinheads who tried to assault their march, and he arranged the permit for the normal parade. Banners included Yes to Family, No to Abnormality, and according to the Polish lesbian gay group KPH, there were Nazi symbols and hate speech as well. At least one normal marcher told reporters that homosexuals couldn't be tolerated in Warsaw because it was the birthplace of the late Pope.
In Israel, Jerusalem City Council advised lesbian gay pride organizers that their upcoming march would be a provocation and upset the sentiments of the wider public who live in or are visiting the city. Pride organizers Jerusalem Open House had already agreed to reschedule the World Pride festivities in light of the Gaza pullout and weren't about to give up their local celebration. They immediately sought help from the courts. But then Israeli Interior Minister Ofir Pines stepped up to announce that he'd already approved Jerusalem's fourth Pride March, trumping the city council, and he confirmed he'd make sure it took place.
The Canadian government's bill for marriage equality had an upturn this week in its roller coaster progress and might even reach its final parliamentary vote in the coming week. Through a combination of inter-party deals and procedural maneuvering, the Liberal Party's minority government won passage of its 2006 federal budget in a late-night vote. Had the budget been voted down, the government would have gone down with it. And as part of the wheeling and dealing, and also late that same night, the Liberals won 64% approval for extending the parliamentary session for the first time in 17 years, specifically to take up the marriage equality bill. Before approving that extension, the Bloc Québécois demanded and received a written guarantee from the Liberals that the session will continue until that bill is voted on. It's expected to pass since it's supported by most Liberals and nearly all the members of Parliament from the Bloc Québécois and the left-wing New Democratic Party. Or, as the outraged opposition Conservative Party's deputy leader Peter MacKay put it, the Liberal Party is now cutting deals with the separatists to appease the socialists to prop up their corrupt government. It now appears the Tories' plans to stall the bill and topple the government have failed.
Also this week in Canada, a court ruling added New Brunswick to the regional jurisdictions where same-gender couples can marry, although the provincial government has not yet decided whether to appeal. In just a few sentences, Court of Queen's Bench Justice Judy Clendenning found that New Brunswick's man and woman common law definition of marriage discriminates in violation of the National Charter of Rights and Freedoms and declared it to refer to two persons instead. She had only to follow an unbroken chain of similar legal decisions in seven other provinces and the Yukon Territory, plus advice to the national government from the Supreme Court of Canada. That means legal marriage for the four same-gender couples who brought the New Brunswick lawsuit. The only remaining regions where same-gender couples cannot legally marry in Canada are Prince Edward Island, Alberta, and the Northwest Territories.
But Canada's Anglicans and the U.S. Episcopalians this week had to defend their gay-supportive positions before the Global Anglican Consultative Council, a major policy body in the World Church. The Episcopal Church USA had consecrated openly partnered gay Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire, while the Anglican Church of Canada includes the Vancouver-area New Westminster Diocese, which offers church blessings to same-gender couples. Both actions are generally viewed as contrary to Anglican beliefs and have created a great rift in the global communion. The Episcopalians' defense included recognizing a genuine holiness in the lives of gays and lesbians, and that their holiness stands in stark contrast with many sinful patterns of sexuality in the world. The report called the notion of a single correct interpretation of Scripture a rather modern idea compared with the long history of debate, and noted that there was probably nothing comparable to modern same-gender couples in the lifetimes of the Bible's authors.
This week's defense was another step in recommendations by a church commission hoping to heal the growing schism. Others included apologies by the two national churches, their agreement to a moratorium on creating bishops with same-gender partners or blessing gay and lesbian couples, and their voluntary temporary withdrawal from active membership on the Consultative Council. This week, the council itself narrowly approved its own motion that the two nations voluntarily withdraw from meetings of its standing and finance committees for 3 years. The council resisted anti-gay leader Archbishop of Nigeria Peter Akinola's move, calling on the Canadians and Americans to withdraw from all other official entities of the communion for the same period. The council endorsed a listening process for non-gay Anglicans to gain more understanding of lesbi-gays.
And finally, this week's most unusual Pride observance. In a first for the New York Stock Exchange, its lone openly gay member, Walter Schubert, on behalf of the U.S. National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, had the ceremonial honor of ringing the closing bell.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 25, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Andy Warhol's superstar in a house dress has been profiled both in print and on screen. Our Steve Pride uncovers the literary and cinematic details later in the program. Have you seen the 1999 Jamie Babbitt movie, But I'm a Cheerleader? Or maybe you're familiar with so-called gay change ministries like Exodus or Desert Stream. If so, you'll know that our next story isn't a new one. A 16-year-old boy comes out to his parents, only to be sent to a reparative therapy ministry in hopes that he'll emerge a happy heterosexual. But this time, there's an unexpected twist in the tale, thanks to a support group the teenager didn't even know he had, and thanks to the internet's ability to forge such alliances in just days instead of months. This Way Out correspondent Jerry Trowbridge logs in with his take on the story.
Gay change ministries depend on building walls, keeping their clients cloistered and away from things gay, immersing them in a world where the only message is one of shame, humiliation, and hellfire, the opposite of where society is going with instant messages, weblogs, citizen journalism, and virtual communities. Consider the case of teenager 16-year-old Zach in Bartlett, Tennessee, in the heart of the United States Bible Belt. And Zach comes out to his parents, and his parents freak out, and 2 weeks later they tell him he's going to a Christian reparative therapy program to suppress his same-sex attractions so that he can live the life they believe that God intended for him. This happens more than we'd like to think. Since it's so based in shame, the kids go off in secret like they're going to summer camp. But this case is different because Zach not only had a blog, he used it to deliver a kind of message in a bottle. E.J. Friedman was the first to see the message.
The way the story came about, I communicated with Zach through MySpace and Instant Messenger several times before the issue actually came up. Then when he proceeded to write on his blog, "All I can think of is killing my mother and killing myself," at that point I just knew I had to do something. And he had asked people to spread the word to try to get people's awareness of what was going on there.
And other people saw it who had blogs of their own. It went from EJ's blog through LiveJournal to a place called LinkFilter that has nothing but links to interesting stuff. And then Terrence Heath out of Washington, D.C., who writes the very popular blog called The Republic of Tea, found it.
I was catching up on my blog reading, and I saw a LinkFilter post about Zach's blog.
There's something haunting about what Zach wrote, about not being suicidal but thinking about it anyway. Even though this was somebody you didn't know, that you couldn't verify even existed. There was enough detail to convince most readers that this was a real 16-year-old, in real pain. Some of the detail was a list of rules that would be enforced at Love in Action. That's the name of the gay change ministry he was being sent away to. Zach found the list, even though he wasn't supposed to see it yet. And he posted it. And he ran away. And he came home, and his parents grounded him, took away his access to the outside world. Except for one post he was able to make when his parents were asleep. And that's where this story becomes a new story, because Zach's story haunted most people who touched it, and they responded by doing everything they could to help it get a wider audience. Terrence Heath got up the next day with Zach's story still haunting him, and he started what is known as a blog swarm.
I posted about it in a number of different places where I either blog or have a diary. I posted about it on my Daily Coast diary. I posted it on the gay spirituality blog that I am a part of. I posted it on homomojo.com. I posted it on the Progressive Blog Alliance blog. And then I sat back and I looked at the comments that I was getting and the sites that were linking to my post and realized that the word was spreading from one blog to another, from one discussion forum to another. I started receiving links from a discussion forum, online discussion forum in Australia, for example.
And in Memphis, a group called Queer Action Coalition formed almost overnight and started daily demonstrations of the Love in Action ministry, all promoted on blogs on the internet. Local media picked it up, but then some of the people helping to create this blog swarm had some second thoughts, like Old Cranky, who writes the blog Disenchanted Forest.
Suddenly, red flags started going up as I realized this isn't an adult who made a conscious decision to put himself in harm's way, stand up for himself, and is willing to take the consequences. This is a 16-year-old kid who's beholden to his family who's put him there, and who's extra vulnerable. My concerns were twofold. Would be one, that some sort of retribution would be taken against him by the people at Refuge because of the protests, because they were just so angry they couldn't control their anger, or they could actually see this as an opportunity to make Zach their poster boy.
Sure enough, we understand through some of Zach's few friends allowed to see him or who've sought him out at the church he's forced to attend as part of the program that he has no idea how widespread his story has become. We hear, too, that his parents have decided that he needs 6 weeks more at the ministry. The cost, from the Love in Action website, is probably around $4,000 to $8,000. This stuff costs a lot of money. Peterson Toscano is a graduate of Love in Action.
All told, I spent 17 years and over $30,000 trying to become straight. I even spent 2 years at the Love in Action residential ex-gay program to try to straighten me out. Ooh, but it did not work. Not for a moment.
And Toscano now does a one-man show about his experiences. He connected through the web and did his one-man show in Memphis last Friday and Saturday night. Meanwhile, Queer in Action tried to de-Zachify their protests and concentrate on the problems with gay change ministries themselves. Love in Action held a press conference where they tried to cast their reparative therapy as if it's just like alcohol abuse programs, but for sex problems. They paraded their success stories before the media. But these are recent graduates. One of them now works there. Love in Action doesn't do well with long-term changes. One of the founders of their program wrote a book about six graduates who turned straight. All six later decided they really were gay, and the book is no longer published. The other founder denounced the program after his best friend, who was also a graduate, committed suicide over depression and his failures to change his orientation. Other groups sprung up. One of them is an activist group started on MySpace, the same blog space as Zach's blog, by other teenagers concerned about what happened to Zach.
This is an issue much more encompassing than that of a religious or gay rights struggle, better described as a struggle for basic human rights. Even teens have the right to decide who they are.
The story reached an LA psychotherapist who filed a complaint with Child Services in Tennessee. There may be other complaints as well. On Thursday, a state spokesman confirmed to Associated Press, who's now covering the story, that there is an investigation that has been opened against Love in Action. And as far as we know, Zach has no idea how many people he moved with a few words on a web page somewhere in cyberspace. For This Way Out, I'm Jerry Trowbridge.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was Jim Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fashion. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, dude.
Which do you like to do first, read the book or watch the movie? Whatever your preference, the recent Penguin Books release of Superstar in a House Dress, The Life and Legend of Jackie Curtis, supports your freedom of choice. Tucked inside the back of the book is an award-winning documentary of the same name. Craig Heiberger created a website, the book, and the film. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with him about his loving tribute.
Jackie Curtis often wore a ratty house dress, and she worked in a factory. So why does she merit a 247-page book about her life and a documentary film narrated by Lily Tomlin? Because Jackie Curtis was born John Holder. The factory belonged to Andy Warhol, and alongside Holly Woodlawn and Candy Darling, Jackie Curtis was one of the first gay superstars.
He was from Manhattan's Lower East Side. He lived and performed, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman. He was a Warhol superstar, a pioneer in underground film and experimental theater, a celebrated playwright and poet. At the nexus of the sexual revolution, gay liberation, and feminism, he became a legend.
Hello, my name is Craig Heiberger. I'm the director of Superstar in a House Dress, The Life and Legend of Jackie Curtis. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is Andy Warhol's hometown, so I was very aware of Warhol's flesh, and it has a really interesting scene with Candy Darling and Jackie Curtis, who are in drag, sitting on a couch, while Joe D'Alessandro is being fooled with by Jerry Miller, and I was very entranced by the whole Warhol crowd, and I wanted more than anything to get into NYU Film School, and that happened, and just one of these amazing things. The first week I was in New York in the dormitory, there was a protest. It was just a couple years after Stonewall, and NYU was hemming and hawing about they were not going to let a gay student group meet on campus. And so there was a big protest in my dormitory. And Jackie Curtis came to that, not because Jackie was necessarily political, but because Jackie really, really loved publicity and knew that there would be photographers and maybe news cameras there. And so I introduced myself to Curtis, and we just became immediate friends. And I started to videotape and film Jackie's performances. And the first thing I did was his full play, Glamour, Glory, and Gold. In the late 60s and early 70s, it was very brave of Jackie Curtis and Holly Woodlawn and Candy Darling to don drag in the daytime and walk around Manhattan, and also even in the nighttime, and go to all these society parties. And they were really very radical, and they were doing something that was very, very unusual in its time. Today we have drag in many movies, even on TV series, on sitcoms. But you'll understand when I tell you that back in the late 70s, when Jackie came to Hollywood and was in an episode of Rhoda, that people do say that the little segment that Jackie was in that show wound up on the cutting room floor because it was just too much for the network censors to let through, because it was too blatantly gay to have a man in obvious drag in a sitcom in primetime. That was just something too cutting edge for 1976-77. Some people looked at Jackie and thought, oh, how shocking, this man trying to look like a woman, he's failing. Well, Jackie wasn't really trying to look like a woman. Jackie was putting on drag in an artistic way. Jackie was more of a performance artist than a drag queen. If you can understand that Jackie would never wear falsies, Jackie would just take a pair of nylons and shred them and put on a dress or a house dress, no falsies, and a wig and a little bit of glitter around the eyes and lipstick, and that was it. And Jackie would go around and have stubble showing, looking like this. And it was an artistic statement. And people accepted Jackie on a creative level. Jackie used to tell me that men, straight men, when he was dressed as a boy, just as himself, didn't like him. And they were offended by something, maybe the slight effeminate nature, something in the voice or the mannerisms. But when Jackie would just simply put on this hint of drag, then they would be completely relaxed around him. And that's a really fascinating thought, you know. And it was really interesting to run around New York in those days in the early 70s with Jackie Curtis and to go to these parties and to see, you know, how people were just drawn to him. He was a really fascinating artist. More than anything, I wanted to commemorate Jackie Curtis as one of the great personalities of his time, who wasn't afraid to be himself. And Jackie's greatest quote, I think, is, "I'm not gay, I'm not straight, I'm not a transsexual, I'm not a transvestite, I'm just me, Jackie."
This has been a conversation with Craig B. Heiberger, John Holder, a.k.a. Jackie Curtis, actor, writer, singer, and superstar, overdosed on heroin in 1985 at the age of 38. Craig's internet tribute to Jackie can be found at jackiecurtis.com. For other web links and information, point your internet browser to prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Who are you? Where did you come from?
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Jerry Trowbridge, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to E.J. Friedman, Terrence Heath, Peterson Toscano, Old Cranky, and Ben Garrett. Lou Reed and Jackie Curtis performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime, online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through charitable donations from our listeners. We thank you. Please find out how you can help keep us on the air. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on 2HOT, Cobar, New South Wales, KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, WREK, Atlanta, Georgia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, to which we know you'll stay tuned.